Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Can you hear me all right? I can hear my echo, so you must be able to hear me. Welcome to ALTSI 2006. Can I please ask you to switch off your mobile phone or any other device that goes bleep or plays a jingle so that we don't get an embarrassing moment later on? Please try to sit close in the lecture theatre. We've got a lot of people here, as you know. It's a largest conference to date, just about, since the last time we came to Edinburgh, which was 2001. So make a friend, sit up close, let people come in, and I hope you're going to enjoy our first session. We've got an overflow theatre as well in the Carnegie Room for anybody who is late. I'm going to be giving some more announcements later on. Quite a few, obviously, about the programme and so on, and just to give you some guidance about the socials tonight, but I'll do that right at the end after we've had the theme speakers' introductions. But for now, I'd like you to welcome Professor Andy Walker, who is Vice Principal of Heriot-Watt University, to welcome us to Heriot-Watt. Andy.
Thank you very much. As Rhonda says, I'm Professor Andy Walker. I'm a professor of physics, but currently my responsibilities are very much focused as being vice principal of the university. And I know I can speak for many colleagues when I say we are particularly pleased that you've chosen our campus for your 2006 conference. So welcome to you all. Although this, of course, is a modern campus, we do have a long history. While Heriot-Watt only became a full university in the 60s, our origins go back to 1821. And in fact, on this basis, we like to argue we are the eighth oldest higher education institution in the UK. Whilst we are now a research-led university, by which I mean our research programmes underpin all aspects of our educational portfolio, we have always been enthusiastic about innovation in teaching. Indeed, when we were established in 1821, it was to develop the skills and understanding of ordinary working people in the areas of engineering, science, and mathematics. And it was as early as 1869 that women were welcomed for the first time as students, 20 years ahead of other institutions. We have continued to be innovative. Our distance learning MBA, now in fully electronic format, has around 8,000 students worldwide currently. And at the other end of the spectrum, our scholar program, which provides a whole range of interactive courses at the A-level Scottish Higher Foundation level, that is being used by around 40,000 students in schools and colleges across Scotland, as well as overseas. I understand we have a large number of international visitors at this conference. I extend a particularly warm welcome to all of you. The campus has one of the highest percentages of overseas students in Scotland, and at the same time, we operate distance and distributed learning programs worldwide, with around 10,000 students altogether studying for our degrees, either independently or with our 50 or so approved partner institutions across 22 different countries. For those of you who are in Scotland for the first time, and this of course includes our UK colleagues, do make sure you take some time to see more of both Edinburgh and Scotland at large. Perhaps not today, the weather is such, I fear, for the whole of today that you are in the best place inside working hard. Let me just conclude by noting our name, which is always of some interest to people, Heriot-Watt. It commemorates two figures from Scottish history. The first is George Heriot, the renowned 16th century goldsmith and financier to King James VI, later James I of England. On his death, he established a major charitable trust, which has supported education in Edinburgh ever since. And secondly, James Watt, the great 18th century inventor and engineer who has his name on light bulbs across the world. So our name might be regarded as symbolising money and power. However, ultimately, like any university, we are first and foremost an educational institution. as I'm sure you do not need telling, learning technologies are just a tool. What we are really all of us about is improving educational methods and opportunities. So in continuing this process of ongoing improvement, I wish your conference every success.
Thank you very much for that warm welcome. And now give another warm welcome to our conference co-chairs, Ron Oliver and Terry Mays.
We're a double act. We've got a microphone each, I think. We'd just like to welcome the delegates formally to the ALT-C conference and say just a few words of thanks to the programme committee, who've worked very hard to put on what I think is a fabulous programme. I'm really excited about the quality of the speakers that we've got for this conference and the programme itself. I would also just echo the point about the international dimension of the conference this year. And it is, I think, impressive that about 100 of the 600 delegates are from overseas. And ALT-C has become a genuine international conference, reflected by the fact that my co-chair has been working very actively from Australia right through the year. So, Ron, do you want to...
I'll just reiterate what you said, Terry. I think we've put together what is going to be a very interesting and valuable program, and we hope that you all take the opportunity to get along to some really good sessions and take home some good ideas, some good friendships and good memories of the conference.
OK.
Thanks.
Thank you. It says on my piece of paper, Ron sits down. It's my privilege to introduce Dr. Diana Oblinger from EDUCAUSE. Diana, I think I'm right in saying, is the only previous keynote speaker to an ALT conference who we've invited back. So that speaks for itself. Diana is Vice President for the EDUCAUSE Teaching and Learning Initiatives and directs the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative itself. Previously, she had a big job as Vice President for Information Resources for the University of North Carolina, which has 16 campuses, which makes it about as big as the HE sector in Scotland. Diana is very well known now as a keynote speaker and an author and a thinker, and we're looking forward very much to hearing again, but this time to hear your reflections on what's happened in the last 4 years. So, Diana, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be back, and I'm going to go very quickly this morning to give you a very quick overview of a number of different issues and take you through sort of my thought process over the last few years, and hope that you will help me see things from your perspective, because this has been one of my struggles over the last few years, is understanding our current generation of students and initially seeing things, but not necessarily understanding what it was all about. So, work in progress. I hope you will help me advance this. And the place that I'd like to begin is by thinking about the context in which we find ourselves. Now, you've already had a quick review of the historical context of higher education. In the UK, we used to only educate men from wealthy families. Women came in. We had the FE colleges join us. And as the context of our world changes, it gets reflected in certain ways in higher education. And what I think I'm seeing is that we're at one of those turning points where the context of our world is shifting in some very subtle ways. And I'm wondering out loud with you how education is actually going to change. So I'll cover some different areas and then talk about what I think some of those implications are. But the place I'd like to begin is with our students, our learners. Because we always say that we do what we do because of them. And maybe it means we should take a bit of time to think about who they are. And I'll give you five generalizations. And these are generalizations. I'm sure we can all think of exceptions to the rule. But think about as you look at our traditional age college students. They're digital. They have no fear of anything technological, do they? They never have even an inclination to pick up an instruction manual. I got a new cell phone about 2 months ago. I carried the instruction manual around, pulled it out on an airplane, thought that I would read it, and suddenly embarrassed myself, put it back away, because you would never, as a younger person, be caught doing anything like that. There's an almost immediate natural comfort with technology. Now, that does not mean that our students understand all there is to know about technology, but they have no fear, so they're digital. Second characteristic, they're always connected. You never see a student who isn't either talking on a mobile phone, texting someone, instant messaging. They're always in connection with the internet, with where they are, with the latest news, with what their friends are doing. Constantly connected in a way that many of us are not. Third characteristic, I think, that we see is they're very experiential. They like to learn by doing. They don't want to just be told. They use technology and other tools to get their hands on different things and learn for themselves. They also have a demand for immediacy that I think we've never seen before. Those of you, if any of you are in college admissions, sending anything through the mail and waiting for a few days or 2 weeks, absolutely unacceptable. 2 minutes waiting for an email is okay, but 2 seconds by IM would be much better, right? There's an immediacy to this generation we've never noticed before. And the final characteristic is one that I want to emphasize because I think we don't quite appreciate its importance in this generation, and that is the degree to which they are social. They come to colleges and universities to be with people. They say that they want to be with faculty, they want to be with students, and they find mechanisms of connecting with people that we might not be comfortable with, where they don't initially meet people face-to-face, but they seem to always be reaching out and connecting with other people. So social is one of the things that I think we don't always appreciate about them. So those are some general statements, a few things about their learning environments. If you look at many of the preferences for learning environments of the current generation of students, they like to learn in a peer-to-peer kind of way. It's not hierarchical the way that I learn in school. It's very much lateral. You ask them where they learn something, oh, from a friend, from a colleague, from someone I know. Very horizontal peer-to-peer kind of approach, isn't it? They also tend to like interaction and engagement. Matter of fact, when we interview students in the United States, they will tell us very consistently, if you don't engage me in lecture, I choose to not pay attention. They feel quite empowered to take their attention and devote it elsewhere. Doesn't mean the same thing as entertainment, but a way of being drawn into the subject rather than simply listening about something. They're visual. They won't just read text. I'll give you an example a little bit later. They read images very well. They like that visual stimulation and can read things into images that I'm simply not comfortable with. My first inclination anytime I try to express myself is to write words on a sheet of paper. Not so for the current generation, much more visual. And the last one, when we look at students in the U.S., given a choice, almost always they will choose to work on things that matter. So rather than solving the problems at the back of the book, they like community service projects, peer learning activities. They do believe they can make a difference in the world. They do believe that science and technology will improve our lives and that they can make a difference. So just a few thoughts about our students. Now, there's another set of characteristics about our students, whether they are adult learners or younger students, that many times we don't take into account, and that is the degree to which they are time constrained. These are some figures from the United States. We have a significant number of our students who are over age 24. Many of our students commute back and forth. They have family responsibilities, older parents, younger kids, lots of things that they are doing. So when we design learning environments now, one of the things we're beginning to think about is just how time-constrained they are and how we begin to make that life a little bit more flexible for them. And at the same time we think about learners, let me tuck in just a footnote about learning, because when we think about learning, I think the automatic default is to think about a classroom, to think about a formal educational environment. And one of the things that is very obvious in the current generation of learners is that's not all there is. There are three types of learning that many people will talk about. There's implicit learning. comes back to me when I come here is that I'm used to driving on one side of the road. You all are used to driving on the other. Nobody has to tell me that. You see it and you instantly assimilate some of that. That's implicit learning. Informal learning, the kind that isn't programmed. You watch a historical show on the television. You read something on the internet. You have a conversation with someone. We learn all the time. Not programmed in a classroom, doesn't take place in slots of time, but almost every moment in our life now has the opportunity to be a learning moment. And so as we begin to think about learning environments, not just constraining ourselves to formal or classroom environments, you begin to see a number of other opportunities for what we might do in education. And then there's this thing that we've begun to understand from cognitive science, and that's neuroplasticity. And basically it says that what you are exposed to changes the way your brain is wired. We used to joke about this with kids saying, you know, sitting in front of green machines or in front of games, that those kids were going to be wired differently. Well, guess what? They probably are. There are plenty of studies we've seen now where young students will play with video games for 2 weeks, and within 2 weeks, the speed at which they have reflexes and make snap decisions changes because of what they've been exposed to. So think about the world that I grew up in. You may be younger than I am. When I grew up, you could play outside, read a book, or watch television. That was it. That was all of the stimulation we had. Think about the current generation of kids that are growing up today. This is some work done 2 years ago looking at children age 6 and below. And basically what it shows you is that at those very young ages, those kids are spending as much time with screen media as they are playing outside. Now, screen media is television, computer games, video. Doesn't mean it's not educational. But think about the visual component alone. Are they being exposed to a world that you and I were not? So maybe there is going to be some difference in terms of the kinds of expectations that they have, as well as the ways that they receive and process information. So just a bit about our learners. One of the things that I think has been very interesting watching learners is that they begin to show us some changes that are happening in our culture. And certainly back when I was a college student, we used to talk about kids being the harbingers of social change, and you saw all kinds of things move through society. If we look at our current generation of young people again, we may see some hints about how our culture is changing. And our culture is simply a set of norms and values, things that we consider normal. So think back 2 years ago. It would have been a little bit odd to see people walking around with earbuds hanging out of their clothes, right? Those little iPod things. Now, if you talk to college students, they say, well, that's simply how you dress. It's become part of our culture. It's quite normal. So there are any number of different ways that technology, I think, is changing our society. And I'll give you a few examples. First one is multimodal communication. My generation used to think about communicating by the telephone. It was the ubiquitous technology of my generation. But that's not enough anymore, is it? Kids are quite comfortable communicating simultaneously, face-to-face, instant messaging. They send pictures on their cell phones because that's another mechanism of communication. Tells you who you're with, what you're doing, what kind of time you're having. And we're now adding geolocation to that. So it's not just what you're doing, who you're with, but where you are. So you can now let people know, hey, I'm on the corner of such and such. If you're anywhere close, ping me and we'll get together. So the modes of our communication have broadened considerably, the ways that we can reach out to other people. Another change I think we see is rather than having someone in authority do it for us or going to an expert, we've become a do-it-yourself kind of culture. How did you make your plans to go on holiday this year? Did you go to a travel agent? Or did you go to a website? When you want medical information, your knee hurts, your elbow hurts, do you go online or do you go to the doctor? For many of us, it doesn't matter hardly what it is. Our first point of contact is to go get information ourselves at that kind of informal learning. If I see something interesting on the television, I'll probably Google it to find out more. So rather than going to traditional authoritative sources now, we really have become an informal learning, do-it-yourself kind of culture. And it goes a little bit farther. One of the other things that I think we see in our environment now that's very common is choice. The whole iPod experience, how that moved through society so very quickly, what was that all about? That was about choosing what you want to listen to in the order you want to listen to it, where and how loud. Our students spend a lot of time developing the perfect playlist. And for many of us, we have TiVo-like devices at home. Even if you only have a remote control, you are choosing what you want to watch when you want to watch it in your own way. So technology has given us a number of tools of choice that we never had before. And as you think about these things that we do in society, I think at the same time we have to compare with what happens in the educational environment and say, if that is an expectation for our daily lives, how is that reflected in our educational environment? Choice. Here's another one that we've seen. With our students, we were initially shocked a couple of years ago when we asked them, how often do you go to the library? And we had lots of students in the U.S. saying, I got through college only going to the library twice. Once was because it was required. The other time I had to find something. They don't consider the library their information universe anymore. It's the web. And the truth is, for most of us, we don't go places and look at physical volumes as our first point of contact for information. We go to Wikipedia, we go to Google, we do many of the kinds of things that our students do. The information universe for most of us has become the internet. Now, that leaves off the discussion about whether it's legitimate information, all of the other things around information literacy, but it's a habit that we've all developed, hasn't it? And Wikipedia was probably the first example of this big shift that I think we're seeing where amateurs are authorized as authorities. Because Wikipedia is simply amateurs, people who love what they do as a hobby, to begin speaking authoritatively. And in the last 2 years, you began to see people blog. You began to see video blogging. Now, not everybody blogs. Not everybody reads blogs. But it has had an impact on society, hasn't it? Because you go to the television channels, you go to the newspapers, and people cite what's happening in the blogosphere. And it has opened up a whole new era of what people call participatory journalism, where it's not just the journalists for Reuters and AP and The Times who get play in the media. It's many people. So amateurs have a stature that they really have never had before, and I suspect that there's really no turning that back. There's something else that's happening in our society, alternate reality. Some of you might call this games. The kind of games that I grew up on, card games, are not the only kind of games that people see now, and this isn't just for kids. Many times when we think about games, the assumption is it's for young people, but in the United States, the average age of a gamer now is something like 38 years old. Those are not kids anymore. People are exposed to games very heavily in their younger years. By the time kids come to college, virtually 100% of our students have been avid game players, and many of them continue. And it has a whole economy around it, doesn't it, that is very rich. And if you look at the figures in the U.S., gaming industry is actually outgrowing the entertainment industry. Lots of changes taking place there. So that's another part of our culture, that even though it may not be right on our frontal lobe, it's part of how people interact with the world. And so one of the questions that I think we many times skip over, and I certainly did for a long time, is to think all of these things are associated with youth, and they're not. If you just ask yourself a few simple questions about how we behave, I can't do things where I don't multitask anymore, can you? Can you listen to a phone call where you're not playing with your email? Very few of us can write anything significant longhand. I mean, I simply can't get my brain to come alive until my finger's on a keyboard. So it's not just them. To a degree, it is all of us, which I think says that we're having some things change in our culture. And this is not debating about whether it's good or bad. It's simply observing that there are some habits that we've developed that are different than maybe we've thought. I'll only say two things about technology, because technology certainly does impact education, it does impact expectations, and it has impacted our society. One is the rate of change. Now, if you are my age, you're probably saying, when is it all going to slow down? How will we ever keep up with all of the changes that people want us to make in our technical infrastructure? Can't do it anymore. Part of the problem is a difference in perspective. Because if you think about someone my age, you go around most of the life cycle, and we went from rotary dial telephones to push-button phones to cellular phones, and you know, things plugged along at a nice, even pace and then took off. But think of the generation of our students. That dotted line, they're on the far side of that. They've really never known life without exponential change, have they? So they adopt and drop technologies very quickly. Obsolescence is simply assumed. We went from CDs to MP3s very quickly, don't know what the next will be, but they will have no difficulty adopting and dropping it because it's not technology to them. It's simply the way you get things done. And we're saying, how are we going to keep up? They aren't even thinking about it. Here's another one of the subtle changes that I think technology is enabling us to do. And Terry and I were talking on the way over here. I'm so 1990s in my approach to the way I think about technology. Because I think about technology as the world to the desktop kind of metaphor. And that is, I have my computer here, and it brings all these wonderful resources to my desktop, doesn't it? But I stand on one side of the computer, and the rest of the world is out there. That's the web. But what do our students do? They live in an Alice in Wonderland type of environment many times, don't they? They go into these immersive environments where they are with virtual people, virtual things. It's kind of like Alice, right? Alice went into Wonderland and there were beings in there. She made something happen. Something happened to her. Back and forth, it was its own world. And she could come back out. And people learn a lot from those immersive reality experiences. Think about something like Flight Simulator. You learn more trying to fly a plane than you do having someone tell you about how to fly a plane. That real experience, and then being able to step back, think about what you did, reflect on your practice, and go back and do it again. That immersive kind of environment is educationally very profound. And our students live there in game environments, but we sometimes don't think about that being an interface that could fundamentally change education. The other environment that we're beginning to see, and I see it most in museum type of environments, is what you might call ubiquitous computing, where rather than me going into the computer is my world, so that I can walk up to a building. They're doing this in Vancouver to get ready for the 2010 Olympics, something called Mythical Muse, where you can go up to a building and say, what's in that building, to your handheld device. It will show you the building, the outline. You can see inside. You can see who's in different places. You can go to the riverside and see what it looked like 200 years ago. You overlay an alternate reality on the physical one. Very powerful learning environment again. But many times we miss that because people like me are stuck in this world to the desktop type of metaphor. So implications, there are lots of implications behind some of this if you believe some of this to be true, and I'll give you just three or four very quickly. One of them is all about connecting. This is not a world about content anymore. It's about connecting with people. It's about connecting with information, where the network becomes actually as important in many cases as what you know. Now, we interview students a lot, try to understand their feelings, and again, brought home to us time and time again is it's very old-fashioned. They want to connect with faculty. They want to connect with people. So many of the things we've always done hold every bit as much true with this generation as in previous generations. They do want to get to know you. But there are some other implications around connection as well. And one of them, if you've read George Seaman's work, he talks about connectivism. Basically, he says that the world of information is moving too rapidly. You'll never be able to know everything you need to know ever again. But that the way you stay on top of things is to be connected into a network of people and a network of information. And through that network, you don't need to know everything, but you need to know someone who does. And that network helps you connect. And when I think about what I learned in graduate school, part of it was the importance of a professional network, wasn't emphasized as an undergraduate, yet it's probably terribly important for all of us now and forever again. And we see social connections. I don't know whether you see as much of this as we do. Lots in our press about the bad side of MySpace and Facebook. There are also some positive sides of it, isn't there? It's about connecting with people. This is one I belong to called LinkedIn. It's a professional network where you can find other professionals for jobs. You can find former graduate students, people you went to school with. It's a way of branching out and connecting to other people in the network. And actually, if you look at some of the research around expertise, expertise isn't just knowing stuff and being able to problem solve better than the next person. Experts organize part of what they know around people. So for me to be more of an expert, I pay attention to what John Seely Brown says, for example. So being socially connected does have value to even people like me. People are connecting in virtual worlds. They are using those as ways of practicing things that happen in the real world. And again, if you read people like John Seely Brown, he will tell you that that is a good rehearsal for real life. It's part of what he talks about in terms of learning to be. And I think we're beginning to see studies where people are learning in those environments. Now, that's not to say all games are educational, all games are well designed. Some do have real educational value. And one of the things that I've begun to get very interested in the last couple of years is the impact that space, our learning spaces, has on how we do education. This is an example from Iowa State University, my alma mater. I actually took classes in this auditorium before it was renovated. And one of the things we many times say to ourselves, well, in a large class, there's no way I can have connections. There's no way to have collaboration. But look at the way that's designed. Flat tiers, much longer than you usually have. One row of chairs is bolted down because they didn't have enough money. They removed the spring from the front set of chairs, so they rotate 270 degrees. And so in a 450-person auditorium, they've all of a sudden turned it into a collaborative space where people can connect. So many times, one of the things that has been in our way of doing things that we might do otherwise educationally has been space. More about that in just a bit. Hallways and passageways, remember informal learning, the ability to bump into people, to develop connections with other folks. That's an important part of why we have campuses, an important part of education. Yet many times we have designed our hallways simply like highways as a passage from point A to point B. We're now rethinking that and thinking, you know, isn't it a good opportunity to have people visible to one another, have a place to sit down and have a conversation, because you never know what you might learn about a subject, about a person, or about another culture. Very interesting things happening with space. Engagement. Second characteristic that I think there are tons of implications around this new learning world that we see. This is the way we, of course, used to design classrooms to be very engaging. You know, if people like computers, we'll just put big monitors in front of people. Not very engaging, right? Change the space, and you change the environment. And that's a picture of something called a scale-up classroom. That one is at MIT. They actually call it TEAL, T-E-A-L. This is the original one, scale-up, North Carolina State University, designed to scale up studio physics to a large lecture hall kind of approach. Over 100 students in a very tight classroom. But the students, notice, are seated at a table. They work in teams of three, high, medium, and low ability student. They share a computer, and they do different kinds of activities. And by the way, student achievement, particularly for women and minorities, is about 30% higher than it is in an average lecture class. The learning persists in subsequent semesters. The students still achieve more later on in physics. And what they do are different types of activities, not much lecture, but everything is kind of public that they do. They do thought problems, ponderables is what they call them. For example, an example might be that you have to figure out how many steps it would take you to walk from Los Angeles to New York, 10 minutes, go to work. Everybody has to try to figure that out. They also do tangibles. problems where they measure things. They use sound. We were rolling tennis balls across the table one day. We were supposed to roll it in an arc, and we had straws, and we were blowing against the ball trying to get it to go in an arc. All kinds of funny things. And you know what happens? It's a very public problem-solving type of environment where you can see what other people are doing. It's like a studio approach, and people spontaneously learn from what they see other people doing. So we would be measuring things one way, look at a group across the room and say, oh, they've got a good idea, and adopt that idea. And it's what John Seely Brown talks about as a studio approach to learning. Think about an architectural studio. And this is one of the things that's very significant behind the environments we create where people learn how to be. Their work is constantly made public. People talk about it. They critique it. You say, well, why don't you do it this way? Somebody else says, well, you can't do it that way because this will happen. And so it's part of being enculturated into the way that a profession thinks. You don't just hear about it. You find out pros and cons, learn from struggles and successes, and it's a very motivating, engaging way of learning. Example of participatory learning, this is a little handheld game called Live Long and Prosper. It uses handheld devices, and you simply walk around the room and mate with infrared. And you see what happens on your handheld, and the point is to figure out the genetic composition. You can also overlay that same base game with an immunological study, where we can be shaking hands and all of a sudden somebody's sick, a few people begin dying, and you have to figure out who was sick coming into the room. It doesn't substitute for lecture, but it's a very engaging, participatory way of getting people into mobilizing their problem-solving activities. Another example using handheld devices from MIT, it's something called environmental detectives. The scenario is people are starting to show up sick in the infirmary, and you are working in teams. You have 2 hours, a certain amount of money to figure out what the problem is. And as students move around campus with their handheld, it has a GPS device. You can see different things as you move through. You can interview folks. You can take soil samples. You can go to the library. And students get emotionally engaged in the problem because it's happening on their own campus. They also have to confront the fact that men and women have very different problem-solving kinds of strategies. So it's not just the science behind it. It's not just the problem-solving. It's also the social skills. And again, very engaging way of learning by doing. And we're now developing a new kind of infrastructure that's going to allow this to go to an even greater level. In the United States, we're creating something called cyber infrastructure. You all are probably participating as well, using internet too, the next generation internet, as a way of collecting samples from the air, the ocean, remotely using robots, having that constant data stream come in, and students can use that live research to learn how to be, to learn to be scientists right beside other scientists. Undergraduate research experiences have always been very motivating. We now have the ability for students not to have to just go to a laboratory, but to be able to participate in a worldwide laboratory with constant data feeds. Visual. They grew up in a world that's much more visual than the one that I grew up in. And this is one I really struggle with because I am not a visual learner. But we all know that a picture is worth 1,000 words. Simulations have always worked very well. This is the old-fashioned one. Temperature is colder, molecules are closer together, it gets warmer, they move farther apart. You carry a lot of meaning in a very simple picture and with a slider bar, right? There are other things we're beginning to see. This is something called Lab 3D that's done at the University of Virginia, and it was initially done as a laboratory simulation. And over here you can see a simulation, if you like CSI and those kinds of crime scenes. This is about gel electrophoresis. So they don't use this just to help students do virtual laboratory experiments. Students practice lab before they come, because you know what they found out? Students read about 2 paragraphs of a lab protocol. Then they go into lab, and you know there were pages and pages and pages of this stuff you were supposed to read, and they have a poor lab experience because they don't understand the apparatus, they don't understand the experience, and by going through it visually, being able to stop and start, the students are much better prepared for what they actually do in the class. another example of changing things from simply a text base to a visual base. This is a course from the University of British Columbia that was an archaeology course. They've changed it now using a gaming engine to allow students to develop virtual fly-throughs. This is their end-of-term project. Students write a term paper together, but they also have to reconstruct parts of ancient Athens, and they reconstruct it using different kinds of theories archaeologically, so they have to explore things in a way that they wouldn't before. And it's been a wonderful example of how people have really changed what's happening. The students say you can't plagiarize this stuff because nobody else has done it, and they began doing a lot more research than they ever had before when they put it in a visual mode. The other interesting side effect is the conversion of survey students, just taking the course, to those who convert to a major is much higher now that they've got the project. And the final thing I'll mention is the shift between formal and informal environments. You remember back earlier we talked about implicit learning, informal learning, and formal learning. And one of the things that we know that has always worked on campus is it's a way of bringing people together. But I think we are rediscovering the importance of space in connecting people. If there's never a place to sit down, never an opportunity to have a conversation, students miss lots of wonderful learning opportunities. So you're seeing a lot of creativity these days around space. That big blackboard in the hallway, that's something called a think stop. People will go there, come out of class, continue thinking right on the blackboard. Some people will stop in the hallway, do a political cartoon. You can walk by and say, what's that all about? And it causes you to have a conversation. It creates a connection between people. So very interesting things that we're beginning to see when we can keep people together. Lots of creativity around student workspaces, because learning should simply ebb and flow from the classroom out into the hallways, into other spaces, and back again. And by what we do with the space, we enable that or discourage it. Seeing huge changes around libraries in the last few years, the shift from library to information commons to what now many people are calling learning commons, where you notice the visibility is different. Rather than floor-to-ceiling stacks, those are waist-high or chest-high so that people have visibility to see the room. Students are encouraged to work. They bring in food. Conversation is actually encouraged in the library, and people are putting services in the library to help students with their problems rather than saying you go wherever it is on campus that you need to get that information. And lots of informal spaces being designed again, seeing people and meeting people is something very important. The top picture is something that some architecture students at MIT created called Steam Cafe. It's really built with plywood. The benches are not terribly comfortable, but the students hang out there all the time. And there are blackboards, there are monitors. People walk by, they see someone, they stop and they have a conversation. And it can be rearranged in the evening for impromptu concerts and all kinds of things. Down at the bottom is what used to be the dead end of a hallway. Rather than just a blank set of walls, they got some people from the community to contribute some things, and they created basically the kitchen table, where students hang out for long periods of time, meeting each other and exchanging places because they can see people, they have conversations, gives them a place to go in between classes. And so we're seeing huge changes as we begin to think about space in the context of the things we've said about learning. You know, you don't have to be uncomfortable to learn. I think we many times used to design those chairs to make people uncomfortable so that they would really be paying attention, getting their mind off of the physical discomfort of the hard wooden seat. Doesn't work that way. We've just completed an e-book that's online now called Learning Spaces, where you can see 30 different case studies of examples of this kind of thing, free download from the web. So if you want to know more, take a look there. But what do you do? I mean, that's lots of information. How do you begin to approach the problem? Well, I would give you five quick suggestions. One is to begin to understand what the principles are that you believe in that make your institution what it is. And I can't tell you what those are. I think they vary depending on whether you have a liberal arts orientation, a science and technology type of institution. But there are some principles that we have to keep first and foremost in our minds, because just doing things without having a purpose maybe isn't so helpful. I think one of the second things that I have learned quite well over the last couple of years is to involve students. Because try as I might, when I try to think the way they do, more times than not, I find out I've misinterpreted things. And students do have a very legitimate perspective on their learning, what works for them, where they're comfortable, where they like to hang out on campus. Doesn't mean that they drive everything, but it does mean that they have a legitimate perspective that should be brought into the balance. And as I said, I keep finding out my instincts are not as accurate as just asking students. Another is to consider the different options that we have. I think highlighted throughout this have been a number of different things that you might begin to think about, making things more visual, mixing the type of delivery for online face-to-face. You think of any number of options, but I do think there are many things that we now have to choose from. I think another component is redefining space. I'll give you just a quick example of how I mean this. If you're sitting in a room like this where the chairs are bolted to the floor and there's a single focal point, you don't feel quite as inclined to talk to the person next to you, do you? Because we're sort of acculturated that you're supposed to be facing forward. If you were all sitting at round tables, it would be much more like being at a dinner party, much more collaborative. You would feel that you had to talk to people. So when we change spaces, many times we change some of our assumptions and inhibitions around the kinds of things we might do in terms of learning. And the last is just a reminder to all of us who do work with technology that simply using technology is not the same thing as integrating technology. Because, you know, years ago, 25, 30 years ago, we talked about how educational TV was going to transform education. It didn't. We used it. But we didn't fundamentally integrate it for what it was good for. We sort of laid it over the top. And so as we use technology, I think we always have to be thinking about whether we're using it or whether we've truly integrated it into a larger process. And I'll end with a quote from an article in Harvard Business Review about resilience, because I think it typifies much of higher education. And what they say is that, you know, your mission may not change, but the world around you is constantly going to be changing, and that the organizations that are successful are those who spend time making the future rather than defending the past. Terry, back to you.
I'd just like to thank Diana very much. That's a masterclass in professional presentation. We actually told her just before she started that she had 10 minutes less than she thought she had, and she finished 1 minute over time, so that's wonderful. But we don't actually have time for questions because we've got to move rapidly onto the theme speaker. Rhonda says we've got time for one question. Do we have a roving microphone? Is it your question, Rhonda? No. Do we have a roving microphone?
Yes.
Is there... This is a point at which, of course, nobody puts their hand up. Do we have a question or a comment on Diana's... I mean, my thought about this is... that I last stood on this platform in 1991 for a conference called HCI 91, and the big issues then were interface design and hypertext and multimedia authoring. And I can't help reflecting on how I would have regarded this this talk today of the truly the next generation, which... And Diana has set the theme for the conference beautifully with this. In 1991, we had no idea the web was coming. We actually didn't have mobile phones even. The world was incredibly different. I can't help reflecting on what it would be like for someone standing here in another 15 years. I seem to have now used up the time for the... Anyway, once more, thank you very much, Diana. This has set the conference off in an absolutely ideal way. Thank you. Could we have the theme leaders up on the platform, please? Well, I think we're extraordinarily lucky in this conference because we have in our theme leaders and theme speakers, we have people who are experienced keynote speakers in their own right, all of them. And I'm going to introduce them one by one. We've asked them to take just 5 minutes to introduce their theme. I had a brief word with Gilly Salmon before we started, and I said, "You've only got 5 minutes, Gilly." And she said, "Are those five tell minutes or five Gilly minutes?" Because Gilly is the only one of my distinguished academic colleagues who calls me tell, which I must admit I rather like. The kind of barrow boy image I rather like that. But Gilly Salmon, of course, I mean all the theme speakers are extremely well known in the field, so I don't need to give elaborate introductions. But Gilly is now the professor of e-learning at the University of Leicester after a very successful 15 years with the Open University Business School, in which she pioneered many of the approaches that she's subsequently written about with tremendous success in her books, E-Moderating and E-Tivities. So Gilly's responsible for the theme Next Generation Learning, and I'll invite Gilly first to come and introduce that theme, please.
Thanks very much, Tal. Morning conference. I've got this opportunity to talk about next generation learning. What I want to do is to try and just give you a start off for this fabulous conference, a vision actually from the past that would take us into the future. So I want you to meet my rock. Okay, now, this is my rock. You can come and touch it later. I spent about 7 weeks this summer writing in Spain, but I did find just a tiny, tiny half an hour to do a bit of diving in this place, which is between Valencia and Alicante on the Costa Blanca coast. And I picked up this rock from that white beach you can see from the Google Earth picture. I think it's just above Tell's head. It's quite difficult to see the bottom of the... we have a geology department at Leicester, and so they, when I brought this rock back, and I can tell you this was all I was able to carry as hand luggage when I came back, so I brought nothing else back from Spain this summer. And this rock started life as marine creatures that were kind of floating about 100 million years ago. And I'm sure, you know, learning has been around just as long. So even though I agree with Diana, we're very much about an instant society and connectivity and so on, really, in a way, learning is age-old and what makes us human. And so I think it's also important to look at our rocks. Now, ultimately, this became metamorphed, in other words, buried and cooked slightly. Okay, now apparently if it had been cooked more, it would have turned into marble. But I think most of us relate to this kind of rock more than we would to the much flashier marble that you get around. And then it became part of the mountains of Spain. It was pushed up into Spain, and then it gradually travels back into the sea where it crumbles. Now, the ones on the beach in the Costa Blanca are only about this big, but this one, because I took it off of the seabed. And if you look carefully, you can actually still see the tiny shells of the marine creatures in there. So this is my metaphor for you for next generation learning. What we essentially need to do is to take this forward based on our legacy for the past. And I do really, really believe, and you'll see that in all the papers in the next generation learning theme, that we have an opportunity the like of which no generation of educators has ever had before. And therefore, a huge responsibility to take our personal rocks forward. There was two kind of big groups in the Next Generation Learning theme. One was very much about these pathways of transformation, the models of change, whether it's an evolution, whether it's a revolution. And then kind of secondly, the pedagogies and the actual nature of learning that enable us to afford this change. And it's almost at two different levels that you can look at it. Very much more, I think, for the first time about creating, designing, enabling, the responsibility we have to put things in place to make it happen in this sort of way. And that I very much welcome. And I thought rather less about the camel of blend than I've seen in the last few years. You know what a camel is, don't you? A horse designed by committee. And so I think that on the shifting patterns that we find ourselves, you'll actually see that the camel of blend is featuring a little less than before, and people are getting more specific about what we actually need to do to enable the new generation of learning. These were roughly, I thought, some of the key things. So I hadn't spoken to Diana before, but you'll see that roughly in this order is more or less what people are going to be talking about, as far as I can tell from the abstracts. Facilitation, collaborating, situated, I thought, was featuring rather more than previously. Also, a lot more people starting to talk about scaling up and volume, and still the flexibility peer-to-peer. And over, as you can see on the right-hand side, some of the technologies they thought they were going to use. I thought the learning objects, virtuality and video, there was only one or two mentions of those. Very much more about the podcasting and blogs and wikis and all the sharing stuff, which was great. Few quotes for you to look out if you want to follow this theme that just struck me as interesting. I'm sure some of these people have been in the audience and you can approach them to see rather more. They were the ones that interested me. And I'll leave you to read them and explore them for yourself very much more. How about this? Web-based media are developing faster than institutions, staff and learners can adapt. Isn't that true? Yeah. Okay, so over to you. Have a fabulous conference. Let's create this new generation of rocks between us. Every single one of these tiny creatures in there has got a part to play. So have a great conference. Thank you very much, colleagues.
Thank you, Jilly. Our next theme speaker is Phil Candy. I first met Philip in an Askalite conference in 2002 when he was National Research Fellow with the Department of Education, Science and Training in Canberra. Since then, Philip, as many of you will know, has made an enormous impact in the UK in various roles with the National Health Service. He has also found time to write extensively about self-directed learning and about information literacy. And it's therefore very appropriate that Phil should be the theme leader for Next Generation Learners. Phil.
Well, thank you very much indeed, colleagues. It's a delight and a pleasure to be here, and especially north of the border. I'd like to congratulate Diana for being invited to come back a second time to speak. I'm often asked back a second time, but generally it's to apologise for the first time. Since time's of the essence, I will be very brief, but this is a very dense presentation, and colleagues are welcome to a copy of this if you find it of any value. But even without the advent and widespread use of technologies, learners in the future could be expected to differ significantly from their counterparts of yesteryear. As representatives of a broader society, much more complex society, from which they're drawn, they could be expected to exhibit characteristics such as greater ethnic and cultural diversity, considerable spread of age groups, varied experiences of family and social life, and very different patterns of work and life experience. When new technologies, as Diana has pointed out, are added into the mix, the challenges for educators, trainers and providers of information are multiplied. I won't have time to step through this excellent presentation, but and I imagine this is well known to many of you. But if not, I encourage you to have a look. Google this guy, Scott Walter, from the University of Kansas, which provides an outstanding overview of what he calls millennials, what other people call screen ages, Generation X, Generation Y, thumb people, whatever a metaphor you like. But he talks about the implications of this new generation of young people coming into higher education in particular. Some introductory comments just to sort of clear the undergrowth. The first one is that all students are learners, or at least we hope so, but not all learners are students. And I've taken literally the challenge to talk about next generation learners, not just next generation students. Refer back to a wonderful paper written by Alan Thomas in 1967, distinguishing at that stage students and members. Not all next generation learners will be millennials, but those that are exhibit a range of generational characteristics. As a parent of three grown up young people, I would have said they all come from different planets, but I decided to just simply say they have a range of generational characteristics that distinguishes them from me and my wife and other members of the human race. Learning is essentially a social act, and we need a conversational paradigm for learning through technology. Happy to elaborate on that if necessary. Learners, irrespective of their age and experience, have inbuilt limits to their capacity. Now, it's interesting to hear Diana say that about neuroplasticity and the fact that prolonged exposure to new technologies and things changes people, but I still think that deep down there are some hardwired limits to people's ability to remember things, and to understand things and to link with more than a certain number of other human beings. And so, to me, technology should complement and amplify those natural characteristics. And lastly, I talk a little bit about how technologies are a platform which is shared by people who do various kinds of scholarly and knowledge-based work. And I think that we need to see learning reinvigorated, if you like, or reaffirm its central place in other forms of scholarly activity in the campus and in our society. So a dozen provocative propositions about the learner of the future, which I've clumped up under four headings in relation to other human beings, in relation to technologies, in relation to content, and in relation to learning itself. Three things for each one. Many next generation learners are less in awe of authority figures than in the past and are more inclined to question the pronouncement of teachers or instructors, especially those whom they don't see, who are invisible to them. Many next generation learners will turn to experts other than formal educators as sources of input and insight, which has got huge implications for the changed role and relationship for lecturers, professors, instructors, tutors and so on. And lastly, many next generation learners are willing and able to help others to learn as peer tutors and or through communities of practice. So I think that the people who are coming into universities, into colleges and schools nowadays, and people who are learners online, are remarkably egalitarian in terms of their willingness to share as well as to learn from others. Next generation learners do not see technology the way lecturers, instructors and administrators do. Excellent paper by Chip Bruce from the University of Indiana at Urbana-Champaign, who talks about the disappearance of technology and how it's truly influential when you no longer talk about it. Many next generation learners will have greater fluency of technologies than previous generations and possibly more than the instructors and people who are helping them to learn. And many find themselves seamlessly surrounded by technologies, immersed, if you like, in a flowing river of technologies. But this isn't universal, and we ought not to lose sight of the fact that a large number of people are still disadvantaged through ethnic background, age, gender, socioeconomic status, and so on. If you have a single unified approach to providing learning for people and they in turn can't access what you've put there, then you're effectively disadvantaging some. In relation to content, many next generation learners don't make a distinction between creating and using information, for example, through blogs and wikis. In other words, they just simply don't think about it. And so discussions with them about plagiarism, collaboration, the ethics of information use, they just haven't got receptor sites for that because they see anything that's available on the web as in the public domain. Many next generation learners are creative, even ecumenical, with respect to information found on the web. They will pick up and utilise information in any form from any source, but therefore there's a greater need for emphasis on information literacy in the digital environment And many next generation learners encounter a vast diversity of information and knowledge claims, more than they can mostly cope with. We need mechanisms to amplify their capacities to harvest and capture this content, and there's a huge difficulty in establishing the provenance of knowledge claims and sources. Again, the fact that if you try and track back where something has actually come from, you often find that it disappears into a fog of misattribution or lack of appropriate bibliographic protocols. Lastly, many next generation learners are used to multitasking and associate learning with social and fun activities, as Diana exemplified. They see learning as a conversational activity, and I think that there's a need to make sure that we put the C back into ICT. It's not just information, it's not just technology, it's information communication technology. When used to transmit large quantities of text, the nature of the technology militates against deep level or transformational learning. Most of us want students not just to acquire isolated atoms of information, but to change their worldview, to have a qualitative shift in their understanding of the world. They talk, however, about surfing and skimming rather than studying online, and therefore more creative use of technologies to challenge learners. Data visualisation, some of the examples that Diana gave. Many next generation learners have been what I say overexposed to PowerPoint. One of the papers we were encouraged to read before coming here is called PowerPoint Shot with Its Own Bullets. And there's another wonderful quote from Edward Tufte who says, "Power corrupts, but PowerPoint corrupts absolutely." And any of you who are interested in his excellent work and the second edition of his booklet on the cognitive style of PowerPoint is encouraged to have a look at it on the web. It's outstandingly thoughtful about the fragmentation, the hierarchical thinking, the loss of connection with extended discourse which PowerPoint often tricks us into. So three things that I'd like to leave you with as challenges through the conference. The first one is, as you're listening to presentations, what are the implicit assumptions that each speaker is making? Are they universally true, or do they apply just to some next generation learners? Secondly, what are the implications for course design, teaching and assessing student learning of those assumptions? And lastly, what can technologies allow us to do that we've never been able to do before? What unique and distinctive pedagogic problems do they solve, and who do they solve them for? So I'll leave you with those as little thought starters.
Thank you very much, Phil. The third theme leader is Terry Anderson, who has the challenge of representing the next generation technology theme. Terry, who I guess by the end of the conference will be called, at least by Gilly Tell, is a professor and Canada research chair in distance education at Athabasca University in Canada, which is really Canada's open university. He's very well published and widely experienced as a speaker on the themes of this conference. So could I invite Terry Anderson to just introduce the theme of next generation technology? Tell.
Well, thanks very much, Terry. And thank you all for inviting me. It's a real thrill to get across the pond and come to Edinburgh. I guess my major thing I wanted to introduce next generation technology with is to tell you to make sure that you come to all the sessions, because there may not be next technology sessions in the future. It seems like it's becoming so ubiquitous, so ingrained in our talk about next generation learners, institutes, or learning. And as I looked at the themes that I reviewed, I noticed that, you know, the Web 2.0 type themes, but they're in every one of the other themes as well. So don't miss the next technology, I guess, is my main point. I'm going to repeat a lot what Diane and others have said, is that the context really defines what happens in a learning environment. And it creates the understanding and the way we think about things. It prescribes the types of learning activities. It defines the capacities necessary to learn and then apply that learning, and it supports social expression and fun. And and I think that the technology, the next generation technology, is the web in many ways. And this is an old slide that I've been using for a long time. When I started thinking about Next Generation, I just got Star Trek all over the mind. But one of the things that was talked about by our other, by other speakers, and you'll hear throughout this conference, is the ubiquitousness of any of information, that it is everywhere. There is all kinds of content. It's in almost any format, anywhere. It's customizable. It's interactive, and it's created by users. And you've seen that. Do you remember in the first generation of Star Trek, they used to go up to the wall and they would ask the computer a question, and any question, and the answer would immediately come back. And you can see how close that was or is getting with Google and Google Answers and Yahoo Answers and those types of tools. But the next generation came along, and the thing that really changed and is part of our next generation of technology too is that they came to the communicator, portable, anywhere. You didn't have to talk to the wall anymore. You just walked around and asked that same ubiquitous question, and there it was all the time. We also see in the presentations adaptive technologies, and it's really interesting to see some of them coming along. We don't have any Geordie for the through blind people yet, but we're getting close, and you'll see one of the themes that comes out in the next technology is how these technologies can be accessible to everybody. And we are all getting older, if you hadn't noticed. Artificial intelligence, again, we don't really have data yet, but it is amazing how people have been talking about artificial intelligence being just around the corner for 25 years. And every time these agents start working, people start saying, well, that's not an agent, that's just programming. And I think that's what's happening, is that our systems, our technologies are becoming more intelligent and more adaptive. So I took the 32 themes in the next technology, topics in the theme, and mind mapped them in some way into some major themes. The first and the largest is the instructional design. Instructional design and applications. You see here the start of looking at VLEs, but also looking at new systems and new ways to combine knowledge and to engage learners. So I was encouraged that was the largest theme, because it's showing that we're not technicians, we're educators, and I think what we're trying to do is use these technologies and combine them in new dynamic, new instructional ways and development tools. Over on the left, you see a lot of e-learning 2.0 stuff, the read-write web, blogs, wikis, podcasting, that sort of thing. It's a big theme throughout this conference. Down at the bottom, as I mentioned earlier, there's access and adaptability, both mobile learning as well as access for all persons. And still a growing interest, and I saw it emerging in other themes as well, about content repositories. And it's interesting, we saw how, the change of things, but just think 2 or 3 years ago, that's all we talked about was learning objects, and then what happened to learning objects? Are we just on a buzz to the next one, or are they still alive and well? And I think you'll see that in the sessions on learning objects how much more sophisticated and more holistic we're thinking about objects and the social communities that are needed to support them. So around this this world of next generation topics, you'll find, I think, 3 or 4 other themes that sort of permeate the individual sessions. And the first one over on the left is the critical or evangelist. I mean, most of us are in the evangelist salesman game of telling people, the sky is falling, get out there, do this, use that. But I'm starting to see some critical explorations of this technology, and I really encourage that. I think we really need to grapple with not just talking to, preaching to the choir and talking to each other. We really need to engage people who have different visions of how teaching and learning and technology get together. Over on the right, you see adoption and integration issues are huge. Can we really keep up with the speed, or can our institutions that Diane illustrated, those great geometric curves? And finally, reflection. How do we get so that we're not just, subsuming all these new technologies, having them wash over us? How are we going to get the time, the energy, and the motivation to work with them? So organizers noted that maybe this would be the theme for a great open source debate. I didn't really see it in the abstracts that I saw. There is one Sakai demonstration, one commercial demonstration, and scattered references to Moodle and other open source tools. But it struck me that open source is not really a burning technological issue. It's really an enabling technology issue. It's finally allowed university or public sector and private sector developers to exchange, to grow, and to work with each other's products. I'm really excited about open access, Creative Commons, subscription, all those sorts of emerging ways to share knowledge, and not just to share knowledge with developed countries, but to share it to everybody in the world. But maybe what we could debate is just the more threatening and controversial is, I think, the very inappropriate use of patent law by Blackboard and SAP and others to try to intimidate their competitors. So, an invitation to attend the terrific next senior at Gen Tech sessions. And I'm really hoping that you'll come and help make those engaging activities such that I can perform on Thursday with an informed, astute, and insightful summary that will need your help. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. The last of our theme leaders is Chris Yap, to lead the theme Next Generation Providers. A few years ago, I had to do a little bit of research into Chris's background because I had to write an introduction, a presentation for him to be presented for an honorary doctorate at my university. And I became quite amazed, really, at Chris's ability to get companies for many years, for about 25 years, he's managed to get companies like Honeywell, ICL, Hewlett-Packard, and now Microsoft to pay him to be a thinker, a reflector, a talker, and an attender of events like this. And he's played a really almost unique role, I think, in the area. And we're really privileged to have Chris as a theme leader as well. So can I introduce Chris and ask him to introduce the theme of Next Generation Providers?
Okay, thanks. So you'll notice it's the Microsoft person who's not inflicting death by PowerPoint on you. Diana's final slide, I think, summed up the real challenge of this section, which is the goal is an organization that invents its future. And I think that's really important in the overall theme of this overall conference, and some of the papers outside the theme, I think, actually reflect some of this. I want to give you some personal reflections, but I want to start by a personal acknowledgement. A number of us here who've had associations with the Open University and with Channel 4 will have noticed with some great sadness 6 weeks ago the death of Naomi Sargent. She was a wonderful, feisty, difficult, problematic, brilliant woman who passionately believed that technology could transform learning and make learning accessible to people who did not find traditional models of learning. The fact that she was her lifelong passion for lifelong learning as an enabler of societal and political change. And so her death has come as a great shock and great sadness to many of us who had the great pleasure of working with her, whether in her OEU days or in Channel 4 or through the Friar Committee and others. So it's a sad moment. I want to reflect on one of the things that Diana was talking about in terms of this neuroplasticity argument, because essentially what we're trying to do with physical spaces is to make them neuroplastic. We're also trying to build institutions, and the danger is that what we've got are analog institutions built for a digital world. 10 years ago, and there are a number of people here I first met at the ICDE conference in my home city, Birmingham, and in the opening keynote conference of that, the principal of Rhode Island College made the following observation. There are only 66 institutions in the world that have survived since the 16th century without fundamental changes to their mission and structure. The Parliament of Iceland, the Parliament of the Isle of Man, the Lutheran Church, the Catholic Church, and 62 universities. N- next weekend, I'm off to a conference in Siena, part of the UK-Italy bilateral, to discuss the crisis in higher education in Europe. And I think we are approaching a crisis. Because I think we're now facing a point where the technology is just becoming ubiquitous. The changes in our uses are beginning to become ubiquitous. And the real challenge we have to think about is how we build institutions that are fun to work in for the supply side, that actually meet a social and economic cause and purpose. And the trouble is, I think, that because of that longevity, because of that enormous history, we find it difficult to imagine a world in which universities don't exist. And therefore, that provides an opportunity for others to move in. I was reflecting, listening to the keynote address and some of the speeches, about the first time I came to a conference in Edinburgh, which was 1981, and it was on the future of manufacturing. And in that conference, we were given a book, and the 19 chapters were on technology, and the last one was on organisation. That book, 10 years later, had one chapter on technology and about 19 on organisation and design. Because in 1981, everybody said it was all about robots and it was about new methods on this. One speaker was booed off at that conference for making the following observation. It's got nothing to do with technology. It's got to do with self-organising teams of problem solvers actually working together to crack problems. It's about removing the idea of a management spread of control of 6-to-1, one manager for 6 staff, to 1-to-100 or 1-to-above. And he went through all of the HR and social factors. The physical layout of the factory changed from the production line to these sort of cell-like. It moved to multi-skilled teams. So many of the most of the people who were there did not listen to those messages. And most of those manufacturers are no longer in existence. Most of those jobs have gone. So the real challenge, I think, of this theme as going forward now is to learn from our experience within our analog institutions what the practices are, what the behaviours are that enable people to be professional on, if you like, the delivery side. I hate that term, but on the supply side. And actually think about what we would do to build new institutions capable of coping with the pace of change of the world and the way in which these connections, the ways in which you can build and use these technologies fundamentally to tie the mission, and I go back to that final slide of Diana's because that is the real challenge. How do we build a set of institutions now that will invent a future that enables everybody on this planet to be a lifelong learner? Technology is the way in which we deliver it, but it's people who've got to invent that future. Enjoy.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you to all four of the theme leaders. And I think we've heard enough already to know that we're going to have a stimulating conference. One thing I should have said earlier was that Diana Obinger is going to be available until tomorrow night and would be happy to engage with the conference, aware that there wasn't much chance for a dialogue. So, Diana, please, if you have any questions for Diana, don't hesitate to put them to her at coffee time. Could I invite Rhonda to come back and give us some, I'm sure, important and practical messages about the rest of the conference? Thank you.
Thanks, Tel. It's going to stick. I didn't introduce myself earlier. I'm Rhonda Rearcher. You've had lots of emails from me already. But now you know what I look like as well. So, and you know where I live. That's even worse. Okay. Can you open your bags? You might want to have a look inside if you haven't done that already. And I'm going to be talking about various things between your bags, and you may want to scribble on your program as you go and mark various things. Another thing you could be doing when you're out in the refreshment in the lounge area is watch the screens in the lounge. There are 4 television screens, and we're putting notices up there each day. And obviously, if you've got an important notice, get that to us, and we can always put that up as well. And whilst you rustle, I'll keep talking. You'll notice some people on the badges have red spots and blue spots. A lot of the people with the spots didn't know what they were for, so I'll explain that now. If you've got a red spot, you're an exhibitor or a sponsor, and we're very grateful for your support, and certainly to all of our sponsors this year, and I'll give you some more details about them later, but they're all in your bag in the programme. If you've got a blue spot, you're on the programme committee. So that means you can collar these people and ask them lots of difficult questions, no doubt. Very glad to have such a large and supportive programme committee this year, and very grateful for all their work in putting the programme together. Okay, so you've had a chance to open your bag. You'll have noticed that you've got the abstracts, and I want to give you a few changes to what's going on. There is one that I haven't been given, but I know is wrong, and that's Isabel Faulkner's abstract is incorrect. I'll try and get you the correct abstract for that, and we'll give that out to you. So apologies for that. Okay. One extra session that you will have had is the Alt-C editors session, which is tomorrow morning. That's Wednesday. At 9 o'clock, that's in your overview program, which is the white printed sheets. And you'll see that we didn't have an abstract for that. Rather appropriately, it's a discussion. So do come along and meet Ian Smith. Is Ian in the audience? Can't see him. Denise Whitelock and Steve Wheeler. I did see Steve earlier. There he is, down the front here, who'll be talking about submissions for next year and pitfalls to avoid, that sort of thing, so you can hear from the editors' mouths, you know, the sort of things that people do and things to avoid when submitting for next year. One of the late changes we had to make was change of room. This is because of network problems. So we had to include a room which is a little bit further away from the others. That's James Naismith Room 136. It's listed in your program as NS136. So you'll see that in appearing in the overview timetable and in the sort of full listing of abstract titles. Allow about 3 minutes to walk to that from here. If you don't all run like I do between buildings, you'll need about 3 minutes. You'll need to walk beyond Scott Russell into the next corridor and along. But there are signs to guide you and a few helpers around as well. So do allow plenty of time to get between the sessions. And it's all undercover, as was mentioned earlier. Socials. You will have noticed the deliberate mistake, I hope. The Cayley is tonight, not tomorrow night, so if you've got a ticket for the Cayley, that is definitely Tuesday, as is the Ghost and Ghoul tour. Dinner tonight for everyone is at 6:30 onwards. Coaches leave at 7:30 for the Ghost and Ghoul tour, so don't be late for that. We want you to have a good time in Edinburgh and not miss the bus. Obviously, if you're staying for the Cayley, you can come along to dinner a little bit later. The Cayley starts at 8 o'clock tonight, and it's in the lower dining hall, so that's beneath where you were having breakfast and where you'll be having lunch later. So down there, the lower dining hall, and the bar, the lectern bar, will be open down there as well. If you can't attend your social, please hand your ticket back to the conference help desk, because there are some people who would like to come along who hadn't booked, etc. So do hand your ticket back if you don't want that. Okay, and last thing I'll tell you about is coffee in the exhibition hall. We have several points in the exhibition hall. If you're really clever, you'll go to the exhibition hall to get your coffee before everybody else and not get caught in the queues anywhere else along the way. So any other questions? Anything anybody's really confused about? Come and see us or see a helper. Enjoy the conference. Thank you very much.